Lincoln High School. Would they stand, please? Good. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with the Court with Class program that is sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. This program has won national awards. The students are invited to come listen to an oral argument, and they have received materials relating to this case and may or may not have had counsel in to argue, to discuss with them the case. At noon, when this argument ends, the students will remain, and Justice Bradley will talk with the students about the procedures used by this court. Anyone who wishes to remain and listen to that presentation is welcome to do so. We've met the students from Wisconsin Rapids Lincoln High School, and I would now like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, with whom you'll meet at noon. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. And to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left of the bench is Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, we will now hear from Attorney Mark Sostrich, who is representing Sarah Connor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and good morning to the class from Wisconsin Rapids. It's always nice to have a big audience. My name is Mark Sostrich. I am counsel for the defendant, the appellant, and the petitioner, Sarah Connor, who is referred to at times in the Court of Appeals opinion in this case simply as Sarah. While this case is complicated with several different issues inviting Supreme Court review regarding the establishment and clear understanding of standards of review by a trial court and an appellate court in considering motions for default judgment and also related follow-up motions to a motion to strike and to default judgment, the factual core of this case centers upon a series of communications involving two different law firms, involving up to four different lawyers and two different secretaries, conveying messages back and forth, and then the belief by the prior counsel for Sarah Connor that he had received what is commonly called a courtesy extension agreement, extending the time in which to answer the complaint that was served in this action to allow him to complete depositions of the plaintiffs in this action. In this case, a motion to strike, the answer was filed after an answer was filed in the case. The answer is 5 days after the statutory time period, based upon its service date. There was a motion for default judgment. There was a conditional motion for leave to file an answer. If the response filed by the defendant was not found to have established a courtesy extension agreement. And then there was a later motion for reconsideration and rehearing, and also for relief under Section 806.07, which the court was discussing in the prior case. Sarah Connor contends that the trial court erroneously exercised discretion in this case on several different issues. In its very brief and somewhat confusing hearing that took place on the first set of motions on November 16, 1998, the trial court rejected defendant's initial counsel, Mr. Stephen Pulich's affidavit, where he states he believes and understood he had an extension of time, a courtesy extension of time, an oral one, with opposing counsel in which to respond to the complaint and filed his answer consistent with that extension grant.
Now, is the trial judge, when we're looking at an erroneous exercise of discretion, in that area of a courtesy extension, as I recall, the trial judge said there was no confirmation. In other words, something in writing, most likely to come from the other counsel or something to be transmitted to the court or something other than I said and you said, and then the court aside. So do you think that that observation by the court was an erroneous exercise of his discretion?
I think the reliance that the court placed on the fact that there was not written confirmation or written stipulation is erroneous for the basis of the court reaching its decision that there was no such extension agreement.
The reason
for that is there is clear case law by this court and the courts of appeals that oral courtesy extension agreements are enforceable. They're enforceable as a result of the ethical obligations that counsel have to each other and to the courts to abide by their agreements. The trial judge in this case said, you didn't confirm it. And in fact, he said it numerous times, and also in his findings of facts and conclusions, there's no confirmation. All attorneys write confirmations. He talked about wearing out dictaphones when he was in practice sending out confirmation letters. And he is correct that lots of attorneys and most attorneys do send out a confirming letter, particularly when they don't know the opposing counsel very well. That's not to say that oral extension agreements are not enforceable and that are not acceptable to this court, which it previously has said they are acceptable in common in the case of Giese versus Giese, which is cited in the brief, and also by the Court of Appeals in Utsberg State Bank versus the United States Savings and Loan Association. If you look through the court's findings, that is one of the principal findings the court made. You didn't confirm it in writing, therefore it didn't exist. The Court of Appeals used that same logic in upholding the trial court, saying, we can't find anything in writing that confirms this. Again, the Court of Appeals is accepting the premise that there has to be some form of confirmation.
Counsel,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think
the court was commenting on the better practice or the practice that perhaps he was familiar with. And that's what, if this court is going to and will be deciding this case, what do you think we should say that where there are opposing affidavits and we have the case law that you gave us, that we should look at these case by case and not have any definitive rule? Don't you think it's a better practice to have something in writing, something with the court?
Well, you've asked several questions.
Okay.
Do I think it's a better practice?
I think the answer is no.
My colleagues are going to answer. I'm sure there's questions out there.
Is it a better practice to confirm it in writing? Absolutely. Had there been a confirmation letter in writing, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't have been fighting at the trial court level, because he would have sent a letter saying, I confirm the extension agreement. Counsel for the plaintiff would have said, we never agreed to that. And he either would have answered or they would have reached some sort of an agreement. Unfortunately, in a common practice, there are instances where attorneys call back and forth, grant each other extensions of time, and do not confirm it in writing. But
you're saying that it's the common practice, that there's no confirmation. It's simply you call up and say, I need 10 days. The other person says, fine.
I'm saying that the better practice is to confirm it in writing. It is a practice that I always attempt to follow so I don't have to be here. Fortunately, I wasn't the first attorney in this case, and I'm arguing somebody else's problem in not sending that confirming letter. But it does take place. It takes place often, for example, in the practice that I have routinely in the Milwaukee area, where I know the litigation bar, and there's many that I deal with on a routine basis. We routinely grant extensions back and forth on an oral basis. We routinely do not confirm them because we rely on each other's situation. However, the better practice, as you ask, would be to confirm this in writing. It would not have led to the problems that we have in this case. The second question you asked is, what should the court do then when confronted with two opposing affidavits? One says there was one, one says there wasn't one. In fact, we had multiple affidavits in this case because there were different people involved in the communications. We had two affidavits from the plaintiff's counsel indicating that neither of them had agreed to an extension. We eventually have two affidavits from the prior counsel, Mr. Polich, saying, I did have an extension, and trying to explain why he requested the extension. Our feeling is that in that instance, and the court is correct, that you'd have to do a case-by-case analysis of those affidavits to determine what would be the better circumstance. Our argument before this court is, considering the preference that this court has shown and the courts of appeal have shown, for a trial on the merits, allowing someone their day in court, and more importantly, the disdain it has showed for default judgments, that when reviewing those affidavits, if it is a clear tie, to in effect use the analogy to the baseball rule, where a tie goes to the runner. When the runner gets to the base at the same time, the throw gets to the base at the same time, weighing the factors that the court considers important in the end interest of justice, that the court should side in favor of going forward with the trial. Now, in this case, I want to point out that going forward and allowing the answer to stand would not have prejudiced the plaintiffs in any way. The plaintiffs have already received a temporary restraining order and then a temporary injunction. There was a hearing on that. Mr. Polich attended the hearing. There's very questionable as to his performance at that hearing, to say the least, when you review the record. But there was a temporary injunction in effect.
Well, counsel, maybe I misunderstand the record, but as I understand the record, the circuit court, Judge Kennedy, I think it was?
Judge Kennedy, yes.
Made a specific finding that there had been no express agreement between counsel.
That is correct. He made a finding, however, and you have to look at what he based his finding on. He based his finding on the fact that there was nothing written confirming that there was such an extension agreement in the first hearing.
But he did have. Did the first attorney, Polich, is that his name, Mr.
Polich?
Did he at any time testify? Did he? He appeared in court. I mean.
He never appeared in court.
He never appeared in court.
In fact, as you go through our brief, one of our other arguments that we ask is, apart from the debate over enforcement of courtesy and extension agreements and how a trial court should review those, is an argument that we have advanced based upon additional case law, to the fact there are circumstances where our counsel's conduct is so egregious that it should not be imputed to the client himself or herself in this case. In this instance, Mr. Polich never appeared at any of the hearings to support his assertion of the courtesy extension agreement. There were three instances in which this could have occurred. On the November 16th hearing in 1998 was the first hearing. I asked Mr. Polich to attend. I received counsel's motion to strike and motion for default judgment after I had become counsel of record in the case, but after the answer had been filed. Called Mr. Polich and said, "What's up? I counted out the numbers of days. You're 5 days late. Did you have an extension?" He said, "Absolutely. There's no problem. Don't worry about it. There must be a misunderstanding because the counsel that's filing the motion is not the one that granted me the extension." I said, "Fine, but you have to give me an affidavit or be prepared to testify to this." And I also pointed out to this counsel, Mr. Polich, that under Wisconsin rules, as interpreted by this court and by the appellate courts, that remedial action must be swift and we must respond right away. Mr. Polich said, "No problem, I'll send you the affidavit." I, in fact, drafted it up, sent it to him, and didn't hear anything from him for weeks. I constantly tried to contact him to come to the hearing to provide the affidavit, and as the record reflects, Mr. Polich did not provide that affidavit until the Friday before the hearing.
Well, from those facts, couldn't the trial court judge make an inference that Mr. Polich, if at the worst was not telling the truth, and at best simply was not credible, he could make a finding of fact that, in fact, there was no express agreement, and how do we upset that?
Doesn't the record support the finding of the court?
No, I don't believe the record does support the finding. The record, what the court had in front of it eventually was two affidavits from Mr. Polich. But the first affidavit, the trial court, said, "Well, this isn't sufficient. It doesn't give me the reason why he wanted the extension, and I do not believe that affidavit is clear saying, I got an extension." I went back to Mr. Polich after the hearing, again by telephone, saying, "I need yet another hearing. We have to follow up on this." The court says it's not satisfied. Plus, the court is relying upon the fact that you didn't confirm this in writing. I can't do anything about the fact that the court, that you didn't confirm it in writing, but I can do something about the questions the court raised. Why did you ask for it? And let's make it clear. He did that in the second affidavit. He explained his rationale, which was a strategic one, which frankly I don't agree with, but it was his strategic one that he wanted to take depositions of the plaintiffs first. I tried to subpoena Mr. Polich to the second hearing. Mr. Polich's response early on was he was no longer counsel of record. He wasn't getting paid. He'd provide me with an affidavit, but it's basically my problem now. Mr. Polich I was not able to serve him on two separate occasions for two different hearings. Was not able to find, to obtain service on him. And he finally did send me the affidavit, said, I did have an extension agreement. This is why I did it. The trial court reviewed that affidavit, and if the court reviews the record, the trial court initially says, it doesn't say anything about an extension agreement in here on my motion for reconsideration or for relief under 80607. The court, in its decision, which it started in the midst of argument, saying, I don't have to hear anymore, let's go on to this, it doesn't say anything in this affidavit that there was an extension agreement. I pointed out to the court, yes, it does. There's a paragraph number 8 where he says, I had an extension agreement to provide me with time until after the depositions. The court glanced down at it, read it, while it was doing its decision, and says, I don't believe it. I think it's self-serving. I don't believe it. You lose.
Judge Kennedy?
Yes. Judge Kennedy then referred to, in his findings, there's no written confirmation. There isn't any writing. The judge also, we believe, used an erroneous exercise of discretion by saying, one, it had to be in writing, but secondly, there was no need for the extension in the first place. You didn't have to have an extension.
Well, isn't there a fundamental difference, though, and this ties into the questions that are being asked by Justice Bablich and Prosser, a fundamental difference between the trial judge saying the agreement wasn't confirmed in writing and therefore it didn't exist, and the trial judge saying the agreement wasn't confirmed in writing and therefore it's unenforceable. I mean, the latter reading of what the trial court did is a legal conclusion that we review de novo. The former is a factual determination that we are required to defer to.
It is a factual conclusion made by the court as a basis for its finding, which is not a factual finding that he should be making at that point to affect his decision.
Well, but which one did he, what did the trial court do? Number one or number two as set forth by Justice Sykes, in your opinion?
The trial court made a factual determination that it didn't believe the affidavits. But it made that determination based upon what it considered the appropriate review of it was one, you didn't confirm it in writing, and two, there wasn't any need for it in the first place. And we challenged the second basis of that. We talked about the fact that it doesn't have to be in writing or doesn't have to be in writing. I believe the court, trial court was incorrect. It doesn't have to be in writing. We raised that to the court. He said, I don't care. That's what the practice is. He put it in his findings of facts and conclusion of the law. That is the practice. You sent out a confirming letter. He didn't do it. The second issue was the court then speculated on whether an extension was necessary in the first place. The court said, Mr. Polich came to the temporary injunction hearing. There were 14 days after that within the normal response period. He could have filed an answer within that. There's no reason shown why he couldn't do that within the 14 days. The affidavits indicate that Mr. Polich had requested an extension and an adjournment of that hearing because he was out of the office on extended periods of time. There is affidavits in the file, one from me, explaining my difficulties in reaching Mr. Polich for follow-up based upon his part-time law practice and his business dealings, particularly in the ski industry, which took him out of his office for large periods of time. But the court speculated, and the Court of Appeals grasped onto that speculation and said, yeah, you don't need an extension of time anyway. There was no need for an extension of time. Well, that argument would be made under any circumstances with regard to filing an answer in a case saying, well, you have 45 days, you don't really need an extension of time in which to file.
Counsel, I don't see this case as either the Court of Appeals or the trial court saying that there is a requirement that a courtesy extension be in writing. Rather, I see it as the trial court considering that the lack of written corroboration is a factor in the trial court's finding that Attorney Polich's affidavit was not credible. Respond to that. Why am I misreading in that statement? Show me how I'm misreading the Court of Appeals opinion that you're suggesting requires a written verification of courtesy extension, or the trial court's holding that you're suggesting requires a written courtesy extension, instead of the way that I am looking at it,
and that is, it's just a factor to consider on the issue of credibility.
My point is it's an impermissible and an improper factor for the court to consider, because the court is saying you didn't do a courtesy extension agreement, and I haven't found any evidence that you did one. He didn't have to do a confirmation of it. The fact that he did not does not affect his credibility. He's following a practice that he had with oral extension agreements, which are allowable under this court's previous rulings.
I saw the trial court as saying, look, there was lots of correspondence, I think there was going back, or some correspondence, I don't want to exaggerate, some correspondence going back and forth, documenting things. There's nothing in that correspondence that documents any extension. Look, Pollack, Attorney Pollack, you're saying you have an extension. The other side is saying they don't have an extension. You're giving me a reason why you thought you were going to get an extension. None of that makes sense. I think it's incredible.
Now, what's wrong with viewing it that way?
I go back to the point that courtesy extension agreements don't have to be in writing, and it's an impermissible and an improper factor for the court, trial court, to rely its decision, to base its decision on the fact that there wasn't one. The correspondence in this court that you're referring to, Your Honor, was very, very limited. There was a letter request for depositions right after the complaint was filed. And there was some very brief correspondence, in fact, involving Mr. Pollack's partner regarding adjournment of the temporary injunction hearing. There wasn't a big series of correspondence going back and forth. And yes, the trial court is right. There's no piece of paper that says, you granted me a courtesy extension agreement, anywhere to be found in there. Counsel Mr. Pollack relied simply upon his understanding of the oral communication. That gets to the second issue, though, however, is Mr. Pollack's understanding of what he had, could that serve as the basis for excusable neglect, allowing that answer which was filed to stand? He did file an answer. He did serve that answer 5 days late under the statutory time period if there wasn't an extension. He firmly believed he had an extension. In fact, when I questioned him about it, and there's an affidavit in the file on that, he said, there's no problem. There's a courtesy extension agreement. What's everybody getting excited about? Obviously, he didn't have to get excited because he wasn't counsel of record at the time, and I was. I was very excited about it. But his point was, I have an extension. I then filed a motion with the court indicating that that is what Mr. Pollack had said, provided the court with the affidavit. The court rejected the affidavit out of hand for those two reasons. One, it speculated that an extension was not necessary, and two, he didn't find that it was confirmed in writing. I then asked the court, please find this as a basis for excusable neglect. Clearly, Mr. Pollack thought he had an extension of time to respond and responded within that extension of time. Further, I also brought to the trial court's attention the fact that I believe that if the trial court found that Mr. Pollack didn't have this extension and it was an unreasonable belief on his part that he had an extension or didn't establish excusable neglect, to carefully consider the conduct of Mr. Pollack and how he handled both his representation of the client before he left as her counsel, and even more importantly, afterwards. When he was asked by me to respond to what had happened in the situation and to provide affidavits, to appear to testify, to explain to the court the basis for the courtesy extension agreement, he did not comply. He sent affidavits late, slowing down the entire process, and we also recognize, and I told him, that responding quickly is one of the things the court looks at. So we also asked the court to consider this to be one of those very narrow cases, one of those very unusual cases, where it would be unjust to impute what the prior counsel did to his client. In this instance, Sarah Connor, engaged counsel, in fact, engaged counsel, as the record indicates, prior to there being a complaint. There was a dispute that existed between her and one of her relatives over the use of the road. She engaged counsel. A letter was sent to her by opposing counsel making a demand. She sent that letter to her counsel saying, please respond. There were some negotiations. A complaint was filed with a temporary restraining order, which was obtained without notice to Mr. Pollack. She immediately sent that to him saying, respond to this. And that's when the request for the depositions took place. She appeared at a temporary injunction hearing with him, And as the record reflects, Mr. Polich did an abysmal job at the temporary injunction hearing. He showed up, told the court he was mystified with what was going on, didn't understand why they were there, and thought that the order had already been granted, confusing the temporary restraining order, which the request for the temporary injunction, which Judge Kennedy then explained to him what the distinction was. He offered no evidence in opposition to the temporary injunction, made no argument in opposition to it, and the Judge Kennedy said this is tantamount to consent to the temporary injunction and entered.
Could I ask you a factual question?
Sure.
The answer was due on July 30th. Was Mr. Polich terminated before that or after that date?
Mr. Polich was terminated significantly after that.
The Court of Appeals was wrong.
If the Court of Appeals is saying, and it does state that you're looking at the client's involvement and what she should have done, I was substituted in as counsel by order of Judge Kennedy in early September. The order signed by the stipulation signed by the parties and by Mr. Polich and myself were in late August, all after the time that the answer had already been filed. So the substitution took place after that. Ms. Conner was dissatisfied with his presentation.
Not the substitution. When did she terminate him?
She did not terminate him until the substitution actually took place. He was still counsel of record and representing her until a substitution took place.
And who filed the answer?
Excuse me?
Who filed the answer?
Mr. Polich filed the answer. Mr. Polich filed the answer. I served it on August 4th. I think the earliest date on the stipulation regarding substitution of counsel is the 19th of August.
The Court of Appeals said in its last paragraph, knowing that she had informed Polich that he would be substituted as counsel before the answer was due, Sarah did not inquire about the status of the answer.
Yeah, there's nothing in the record indicating that that took place, Your Honor. I don't know if the Court of Appeals misunderstood the timing or did not notice the dates on the substitution of counsel. She was dissatisfied after the hearing, and there was reference in the brief that shortly thereafter she said, I want a new attorney to come on board on this because I wasn't happy. But that happened, the dates are shown on the record as happening after the answer was filed. Mr. Polich filed the answer. He sent in the answer. Now, Mr. Polich said in his affidavit that he knew that the client was dissatisfied and that she had indicated that she was going to be substituting counsel into the action later, and he went ahead and filed the answer. He said, well, I'm counsel of record. I better clean this all up before I'm gone. And he did. That's when he submitted it. I followed up with him after I became counsel of record because when I became counsel of record, I served interrogatories, requests for the production of documents. We started conducting depositions. And then after those proceedings were started, counsel for the plaintiff moved to strike, indicating that the answer had been served 5 days late.
Counsel, on a side issue, I had some concern about issues of credibility being determined on affidavit, and that appropriately there should be a hearing, and there's something in the transcript that was denied. The Court of Appeals, however, indicated in its opinion that your client waived the issue of whether an evidentiary hearing was required, that your client was given the opportunity for one and declined it.
The circumstances on that were on the original November 16th hearing. I did request an evidentiary hearing and informed the court that Mr. Polich wasn't there and it indicated a conflict. The court indicated that I made that request while it was starting to make its decision and therefore I was too late. If you review the transcript of that hearing, it was a little bit confused. The court wasn't quite certain which motions it had in front of it. There was a conversation back and forth between counsel and the court began rendering its decision. I said, we don't have Mr. Polich. We'd like to have an evidentiary hearing. The next hearing that was scheduled for January 11th. It was at my request. I was intending to have Mr. Polich testify. He would not voluntarily appear. I attempted to subpoena him in his affidavit in a file indicating that I used Sheriff's Department and also private process servers to try to trace him down and have him come to the hearing. He was nowhere to be found. He did not respond to my calls. That hearing was adjourned by the court, not by me. to March 29th, giving me an additional opportunity to try to track down Mr. Polich, which I did. Subpoenas went out again to try to get him to that hearing, and I followed up with communications with him. All I received was the affidavit that was placed on file. So the trial court said, okay, Mr. Sosnich, we're here. You've tried to get Mr. Polich. I explained to the court the efforts that I had made to attempt to get him there to respond, and I said, all I have for Mr. Polich are the affidavits, and we will have to rely upon those because I'm not going to get him here. I questioned whether the court could order him there as an officer of the court, and as the transcript will reflect, the court even said, I don't know if I can order him here because he lives outside of the state of Wisconsin. And Mr. Polich did not appear, and we went forward with the hearing. It wasn't a waiver that we made happily, but it was a reference to the court's request. Can you come back with him? I told, and there's quite a lengthy dissertation for me on that, going with the court. This is what we've tried. He's not coming, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I see that my time is up, and I certainly will make comments on rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Stebning Rowe, representing Anderson B. Connor and Thelma A. Connor.
Good morning, Justices, and good morning, Mr. Sosnich. Ann Stebning Rowe appears for the plaintiffs and respondents, Thelma and Anderson Connor. Thelma Connor is also here today, Your Honor. The situation presented here is one where this summons was served with the 45 days to answer about a month and a half after the statutes enlarged the time to answer from 20 days to 45 days. So we were in the 45-day period following a time period when counsel were used to answering within 20 days. The summons was served upon Sarah Connor, and the summons clearly set forth that the answer and response was due within 45 days of service. The record indicates that Mr. Polich had the summons and complaint the very next day, so he had 45 days to answer. Thereafter, the injunction hearing was adjourned at his request, and there were documents and letters regarding a request to schedule deposition. There was two phone messages from Mr. Polich in one 2-hour frame of time, followed up by a fax letter asking for dates for deposition. Nothing in that letter said anything about needing to have the depositions in order to respond in these proceedings. The letter was followed up with another fax letter back to him indicating which of those dates worked, and nothing further was presented, nothing further is in the record, and that there's nothing further presented by Sarah or Attorney Polich regarding any kind of extension. The hearing was held in front of Judge Kennedy for the temporary injunction, and 14 days later was when the answer was due. Mr. Polich did not file his first affidavit until just a few days before that November 16th hearing, even though the answer was due on July 30th. The motion for default judgment and the motion to strike was filed in September, more than 2 months before the first hearing. The motion for enlargement of time for the answer and this first affidavit to try to meet their burden of proof as far as excusable neglect is concerned was not filed until a few days before that November 16th hearing. Nothing was mentioned by attorney for Sarah Connor regarding an adjournment prior to the start of the hearing. It was clear that they were proceeding based upon those affidavits. As Judge Kennedy indicates in the transcript, it was not until it was clear that it was not going their way that they asked for an adjournment. But what Judge Kennedy looked at was that filed with the motion for default judgment was an affidavit that said no request for an extension was ever made, nor was one ever granted. 2 months later, Mr. Polich files an affidavit that sets forth no express agreement for an extension. What he said was that there were never any conversations with Attorney Stebning Rowe regarding an extension, and that based upon the conversations with mutual cooperation with Attorney Patrick Juneau, I perceived I would be able to have an extension. And Judge Kennedy said those affidavits were not conflicting because he had two affidavits from Attorney Patrick Juneau and Attorney Stevening Rowe saying there was no extension, and from Mr. Pollitz just this understanding that if he wanted one, he could have gotten one. So based upon that failure to meet their burden of proof, and the Leonard versus Cadahaw case clearly says that the non-responding party that's late with their answer has the duty to prove excusable neglect, that he did not find that there was an express agreement. Then he also buttressed that with a time frame that in 14 days after the hearing, when this issue was in the forefront of Mr. Pollitz's consideration, he certainly had time to file an answer before it was due. Now, keep in mind that this was 14 days coming right after the time that all attorneys had to respond within 20 days. So 14 days was a considerable amount of time in that context. Also, in the case of Leonard versus Cadahaw, the court considered whether an attorney, despite their press of business, could have filed an answer or could have filed a motion to enlarge the time to answer. So that was appropriate for Judge Kennedy to consider and for the appellate court to also concur in that decision. That part of excusable neglect is not just whether there was a good reason, but also whether it was necessary. On that basis, Judge Kennedy, with all the evidence before him at the November 16th hearing, which was Sarah Connor's burden to prove, said there was no express agreement, there are no excusable neglect circumstances, especially in light of the fact that there's no corroboration, there's nothing in writing. And he did indicate the ease with which one could confirm those things in writing. So the default judgment was granted after he struck the untimely answer.
Judge Kennedy made no finding with respect to extraordinary circumstances, did he?
No, he did not, Your Honor.
Was he asked to?
No, Your Honor, not at the November 16th hearing, not at all.
Do you think an appropriate remedy here would be to send him back and let him make a determination on extraordinary circumstances?
No, Your Honor, because this case does not even come close to those rare circumstances as outlined by this court in MLB case. In that case, the court made it very clear that it was supposed to be sparingly used, as Justice Bradley said, and not to overturn the finality of a judgment. There were extraordinary circumstances, and in fact, the court didn't say, yes, you can come back in and reopen the judgment. In MLB, the court said, yes, Judge, you can hear the case on whether to reopen under these circumstances. There, the judge said, I find the evidence in support of the defendant DGH's position credible. I find their position truthful, but the judge did not believe as a matter of law he was allowed to reopen after that one-year period under 806-07-H. Here it's so different because the judge didn't believe that evidence.
Do you believe that extraordinary circumstances can never exist if there is not excusable neglect? In other words, is excusable neglect a sine qua non to a finding of an extraordinary circumstance?
No, Your Honor. I guess I can't think of when an extraordinary circumstance would exist in that scenario.
There was some kind of excusable neglect.
Huh? Right. But here, this is just a routine default judgment case, and it does not present extraordinary circumstances. Plus, I think it should be pointed out that none of the factors that the court considered in MLB from the defendant, DGH, there was no affidavits ever filed by Sarah Connor regarding any allegation of extraordinary effects on her, nor was her testimony ever offered as to any steps she took. So they had the burden to put that in the record, and the record is absolutely silent as to any effect on her, any steps she took. And as to the prior question of Justice Prosser, in the second affidavit of Attorney Pollitz, which is at Record 31, page 2, He did indicate that he was told by Sarah Connor's agent before he filed the answer that he would be discharged from the case. And so it is true that there's nothing in the record to show that Sarah Connor or her agent then followed up to verify whether an answer was filed. When that contact took place, the record doesn't make clear, but he did indicate in his second affidavit that he was told he was being discharged before he filed that late answer on August 5th, before he didn't file it that day, but before he served it by mail.
Could I ask you a couple of questions here? This attorney alleges that he was interested in taking depositions of the plaintiffs before filing an answer.
Yes.
That's correct?
That's what he alleges in his second affidavit before the March hearing.
Well, he also alleges that counsel representing the plaintiffs agreed to have depositions taken on July 17th, 1998. Is that true or false?
We never scheduled depositions, Justice Prosser. My letter is attached to my affidavit where I indicate two dates that would fit in my calendar, and that if he got back to me, I would check those dates with my client, and nothing further took place.
So are you saying when he swears, in fact, counsel agreed and the depositions were initially set for July 17, 1998. Is that not true?
The letter indicates that that date was available, but nothing was set for that date. So that is untrue.
Plaintiffs proceeded with their temporary restraining order hearing and requested that the deposition scheduled for July 17th be delayed. Is that not true?
We did proceed with the injunction hearing, but there were no depositions scheduled, so nothing was delayed.
You never requested anything?
No.
So you're alleging that there are several things in these affidavits that are not true.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that's part of what bothered the court as far as the credibility. There are many issues regarding credibility that Judge Kennedy put in the record at the hearing in March. And in fact, he asked two or three times, are you sure you want to go forward without a hearing? I will adjourn it if you want to adjourn it and try to bring Mr. Pollich before this court. And that was waived by Sarah Connor's counsel. And they said that we want this finalized one way or the other so we can pursue Mr. Pollich.
Well, and they, it seems to me both counsel here this morning are basically charging Mr. Pollich with not being very reliable or truthful. Why should Sarah Connor be saddled with all that?
Your Honor, if every attorney's neglect or inexcusable conduct in filing a late answer were to excuse the defendant, we would not have default judgment. And the statutes provide for default judgment. They provide for a time within which one can move to enlarge the time to answer, and they provide for the finality of default judgment unless excusable neglect can be found. Also, as the appellate court determined, the case of Charlay Reading indicates that in order to be relieved of the misconduct or the lack of perseverance by their attorney, the defendant needs to take some responsibility and make some inquiry. The summons was served on Sarah Connor personally with the 45-day notice, and nothing in this record shows any attempt on her part to make any inquiry. And that's what Charlay Breeding said the defendant had to do in order to be relieved of her attorney's neglect.
Counsel, I want to put a little flesh on the bones here, because this so far has been totally procedural arguments. And yet, extraordinary circumstance argument does address itself at times to the interests of justice. We've got MLB, I think, with the clear finding that, hey, it is extraordinary when a person's been found to be a father when, in fact, he couldn't have been. As I understand the facts in this case, and that's what I want to talk about just a little bit, this logging road that your clients want to continue to use runs alongside a bank, the lake. And that, in fact, Ms. O'Connor, Sarah O'Connor, improved an alternative road that was farther back in order to allow access to the properties, both as a concern for this road so as to alleviate any traffic going past her property, but also to alleviate any potential environmental damage to the lake. In other words, make the road unusable. Is that what the facts are here?
No, Your Honor. The road was not a logging road. It was the historic access road, first of all, to the village of Leona from the railroad, but more importantly, for Anderson Connor's family for decades. It was the access road to their cabin. And the easement that was attached to the complaint here was recorded in 1955. And the affidavit in the complaint of Mr. Anderson Connor showed that, in fact, his family used that road for decades prior to the filing of the easement.
Sure, but I mean, you can't argue that, for instance, a pit that's been used for the dumping of garbage, it's okay to continue to use to dump garbage because it's been dumped there for 40 years. So I want to explore just a little bit this, the bigger picture.
The so-called alternate road that Sarah Connor put in place was a circuitous route through the woods. It had several steep hills, which my clients were concerned about. They have a daughter with diabetes that was in the affidavit in the record, that they would not have good access to the town services, fire services, ambulance services. Plus, part of that so-called alternative road crossed another person's property, and there was no proof that Sarah Connor had permission from that other landowner for that road going across the property, and my clients had no easement rights across that land. So those were issues that were raised in the complaint and in the affidavit in support of the complaint and testified to by Anderson Connor at the injunction hearing in this matter, that the road was not safe and it wasn't fully improved and wasn't safe for travel before she put a wire across the easement road and put trees over it, thereby barring any use by any other party. That at that point in time it was still in very rough condition and was not further improved with grading and gravel until sometime after she put the barriers in place. But there are significant reasons why my clients did not want to use that alternative road even after it was improved. But it must be pointed out it was improved after the barricades were put in place. We still have no proof of any permission from the other landowners whose land it crosses for that easement or access by anybody.
Thank you for indulging.
As far as the other information that Judge Kennedy relied upon, he relied upon the fact that second affidavit that first raised these issues about a deposition was filed 5 months after the motion for default. That bothered him as to credibility that these new issues came up that long afterward. It also bothered him about credibility that these were facts. Affidavit before the November 16th hearing and were not. If those facts were really truthful, he could have and should have raised them before the November 16th hearing. He also said that there was no reason to need depositions to answer in a case like this. And again, that kind of logic by the trial court is supported by the Leonard v. Cataha case, that whether there's a need for an extension and whether is material to the findings. And there was no documentary evidence to support his claim that he had a courtesy extension. In fact, in his first affidavit, he very specifically states that there were no conversations with myself regarding an extension to answer. Yet in his second affidavit, he says that all of this centered around depositions, and all of the correspondence regarding depositions was with myself. That in itself is incredible and doesn't make sense. if he didn't have that conversation with me, but all of the telephone messages and letters regarding depositions were with me. That doesn't make any sense that he was asking for an extension to reschedule or adjourn depositions before he answered. And in fact, the fact that he answered although late without depositions belied that point and affected the credibility in Judge Kennedy's eyes. So Judge Kennedy and the Court of Appeals went forward on the basis of credibility. And the case law is very clear from Petke to Leonard v. Cadahaw that the court has a great deal of discretion in making those findings of fact. And we do not see that Hedke should be overturned. And in fact, in making the MLB case, this court didn't say that those factors were overturning Hedke. Since the Hedke decision, the legislature has acted to extend the time to answer, but they did nothing to change the formula of 801.15, requiring that you move to extend the time before the deadline to answer. So all of those factors are there. We have 801.15 that says you have to move to extend the time to answer before the deadline. It was not done here. No motion to extend was filed until mid-November, just prior to the November 16th hearing. We don't fit any excusable neglect criteria as set forth by this court in Hedke versus Century Insurance. And therefore, I think that the judge's decision and the discretion he used following the factors outlined by this court in Hedke versus Century Insurance and by the appellate courts in Leonard v. Cadahaw should be sustained. He made findings of fact based upon the evidence that was before him, and the problem with the evidence was not of the plaintiff's making. It was because Sarah Connor went forward based upon those affidavits and did not accept the court's offer to adjourn the hearing in order to try to secure Mr. Pollich's testimony. The court made it clear that he would rather hear testimony than decide on affidavits when you have conflicting affidavits. But at the first hearing, he said they're not conflicting because he doesn't say expressly that he had an agreement. At the second hearing, because of the timing and also because of the other factors, he found that affidavit unbelievable.
Do you think this court should just write an opinion that adopts Hedke's statement of the law and says there's no abuse of no erroneous exercise of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your view of the...
Yes, I don't believe that there are any extraordinary circumstances here. Default judgment is the method put forth in our statutes. It's the method put forth by the Hedke versus Century Insurance case. Sometimes those make difficult results for a party. If a plaintiff misses a statute of limitations deadline, they don't have their day in court. That is the deadline. There needs to be a finality to judgments, a finality in the system. And if we gave defendants 180 days to answer, we'd probably still have some people coming before the court claiming that excusable neglect because they missed a filing deadline. You know, we cannot keep things open forever in our courts of law, or as the court said in, I think it was Hedke's, quoting a prior case, that we have an uncomfortable perception in the public if litigation goes on forever, and also if attorneys' neglect is excused by the courts. And I don't think that that should be permitted here.
Would you just follow up, and I know you addressed this earlier with Justice Prosser, but I hear you saying that Attorney Pollich engaged in questionable practice. And I hear your opposing counsel perhaps saying, well, if he did, don't hold it against my client. If we have everyone pointing fingers at Attorney Pollich, let's say, okay, maybe there were some problems, but why hold it against Attorney Pollich's client? So tell me why, on this case, on these facts, his
alleged problems should be imputed to the client.
I don't think there's any facts in the record to show impropriety of his conduct prior to the missed deadline. There's nothing, you know, that shows any kind of problem with his conduct. I believe that Justice Kennedy perceived that second affidavit, and so do I, as being self-serving and not fully truthful. But that's long after the fact. It does not relieve Sarah Connor from the effect of missing the deadline to answer, which is a default judgment. And it does not relieve her of her burden under the Charlet Reading case of making inquiry, especially as the Court of Appeals noted that according to Attorney Polich's second affidavit, he was being told before he filed that late answer that you're going to be discharged, and that she should have made some inquiry regarding the status of the answer. She was served with the summons that said 45 days to answer, and there's nothing in the record to show she should be relieved of that burden, frankly. There's no affidavit from Sarah Connor. There's no testimony ever offered from Sarah Connor indicating that she took any steps to protect her own position.
There's a whole series of cases that deal with sanctions where the lawyer has not appropriately handled pleadings or depositions, et cetera, or hasn't obeyed an order of the court, and the sanctions might be imposed against the client, like dismissal of the case. I don't think you cited that line of cases, but is that really what you're relying on?
No, I'm relying upon the cases that deal directly with default judgment, because all of those deal, most of them deal with an attorney who missed the deadline, and the default judgment is taken against that attorney's client. Whether it's Leonard v. Cattahaw or Hedke versus Century Insurance, those are all default judgment cases where an attorney missed the filing deadline and the default judgment is entered against the attorney's client.
It's straight agency doctrine.
Pardon?
It is straight agency doctrine. You're bound by the acts of your agent unless there's some reason that you should not be bound. Unless you've done everything you can to deal with the agent so that the agent couldn't do this to you, but if you don't take those steps, you're bound by the agent. Isn't that the general rule you're applying?
Right, and here Mr. Polich did put in an appearance. He had not filed a formal notice of retainer, to my knowledge, before that injunction hearing, but he put in an appearance at that hearing representing that he was the attorney for Sarah Connor. And, in fact, he did admit in his affidavits that he got the summons and complaint 45 days before the answer was due. So, yes, I believe she's bound by it. I think otherwise, as the Court of Appeals said, we would never have default judgment, because invariably the mistake of the attorney is visited upon the defendant whose answer is not timely filed.
You folks got an injunction before Sarah Polk was served, is that right?
A temporary restraining order, yes.
Why did you do that?
Because of the timeline with the summer and not knowing what the scheduling would be and my client's desire to use their cabin before the summer went by. So we did ask for an ex parte temporary restraining order so that they would be permitted to use their cabin and use the only developed and improved road to their cabin.
If you prevail in this matter, does that settle this case forever?
Yes, the injunction is for that recorded easement road and would be in place. Oddly enough, one of these federal cases cited in MLB indicates that with an injunction, if there's a change of circumstances in the future, there might be a lack of need for an injunction down the line, which would enable someone to try to seek relief in the future from that injunction. I guess an example would be if my clients or their family or the successors in their cabin interest had abandoned that use of the road for a long period of time. Perhaps that would be, and that was the example given of an extraordinary circumstance in the federal courts in the MLB case with regard to an injunction. But yes, we would. The default judgment was for a permanent injunction to permit my clients and their successors to use that easement road to their cabin, and the easement document itself was for as long as they were using the cabin and their successors. So it would settle things. It would be the finality of the judgment, that is the balancing between reopening and a day in court and having things go quickly to finality and the finality of the judgment, or the sanctity of the finality of the judgment as expressed in MLB.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sastrich, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Following up on the questioning of Justice Prosser, the judgment in this case is very significant in what was entered, and that this is not a simple case where Sarah Connor's principal remedy now, depending on how this court rules and if it upholds the trial court and court of appeals, she is left with a permanent injunction affecting real estate in perpetuity. This is not one that she can simply follow up with a malpractice action against Mr. Polish and say, okay, give me back my property without this easement on it. He won't be able to do that. A monetary award will never put her back to where she should have been had Mr. Polish properly followed up, under our view of the case, with me in providing affidavits and testimony to the court. So there is a significant situation here where we do believe the facts of this case are extraordinary, and we did bring this up to the court at the March 29th hearing. The effect on real estate is something very special and found as unique in, under Wisconsin law. We believe that what makes this case different than a simple default judgment on a personal note, for example, for $10,000.
Make it different than a default judgment on a wrongful death claim or a default judgment on a personal injury claim where arguably no money will compensate for the loss of my child or no money will compensate for the loss of my arm.
Correct, but if there is attorney negligence, the result of that lawsuit for that malpractice is compensation, is money. The same thing that you would get in the wrongful death action that the attorney may have blundered. In this case, she will never get that property back free of that permanent injunction creating that easement right. Now, questions were asked about these roads on the property, and there was not testimony because we never got to testimony on the merits regarding the roadway. There was some testimony at the temporary injunction hearing, and as I advised the court, Mr. Polich did not offer any witnesses in opposition to it, though Sarah Connor was sitting right there with him, and simply indicated to the court that he thought that they had already agreed, in fact, to a temporary injunction. But there are two logging roadways that Mr. and Mrs. Anderson can use to get to their property. The roadways around Birch Lake are owned and controlled by members of the Connor family and various relatives of the Connor family. Sarah Connor made clear her interest in improving a second roadway to avoid continued use of the Lakeshore roadway for a number of reasons, including her plans to build, but also including environmental concerns and factors. And she, in fact, even met with an organization known as the Birch Lake Homeowners Association to present those plans. So there'd be extensive testimony about whether the roadways were adequate or not. The testimony that Mr. Anderson said that the roadway was not improved at the temporary injunction hearing is not quite correct. He said he didn't know if it wasn't improved. He wasn't going to take the chance of going over that roadway and find out that it was not completely improved. That roadway is improved. People are using it today, the alternative roadway. The question was also raised, what was Ms. Connor's requirements in dealing with her counsel? She's dealing with her counsel who's telling me, who later told me the same things that she told her. I got an extension of time. I've got this agreement, I've got that agreement.
Is that in the record any place that they had any discussion during the relevant time period regarding the filing of an answer?
That she had discussions with him? Not until, there is nothing on the record indicating her conversations with him regarding an answer, because the answer came in prior to him leaving the case, and she received the answer and did not realize that there was anything supposedly wrong with the answer until afterwards.
The response from your opposing counsel with regard to, why imputed to the client was in part that, look, some of this, parentheses, egregious behavior happened, you know, the alleged untruths, happened months later. We're talking about whether or not the client should be took reasonable, as the Court of Appeals said, made reasonable efforts or inquiry during the relevant period. And is there anything in, and the Court of Appeals said there's nothing in the record.
There is nothing in the record regarding communications between Sarah Connor and Mr. Polich other than her dissatisfaction with him at the temporary injunction hearing and her conveyance to him that she was going to replace him. That's all that is in there. But if you follow what is in the record and take it to its logical conclusion in making its inferences, the answer that he filed was based upon what he believed to be an extension of time that which he had. He didn't believe that there was any problem with filing.
Doesn't that make us a fact finder?
Doesn't that make you a fact finder? It goes back to whether the court considered proper factors when it made its decision that I reject what Mr. Polich says. And Justice Prosser pointed out there was a number of things that Mr. Polich said happened that counsel for the plaintiff says doesn't happen. There were communications between the two offices, and one is explained at length in the brief how one of his communications was made by a phone message to Mr. Juno, a partner of Ms. Stebbing-Rowe. Mr. Juno got a message, a phone message, transferred it to Ms. Stebbing-Rowe's secretary, because she was out of the office. Secretary called Ms. Stebbing-Rowe. Ms. Stebbing-Rowe referred back to the secretary. The secretary then called Mr. Polich's office. He's gone, and it's left with his partner. Mr. Polich included that in his consideration and belief that he had some form of an extension agreement. So counsel made a reference to the fact that Mr. Polich and I did not have direct conversations on things. That is correct. There was a convoluted series of different people involved in that. Now, does that underscore what Judge Kennedy said, that it would have made more sense for him to confirm that in writing? Yes. And Justice Wilcox pointed out the preferred practice would have been write a simple letter of confirmation. We'd avoid all this problems. Is that Sarah Connor's fault, however? Sarah Connor's view of the case at the time that the motion was filed was everything was fine, that she had done what a client should do. She engaged counsel, in fact, when the dispute arose. She gave counsel the summons and complaint and temporary restraining order, which had been obtained even when opposing counsel knew that she was represented by counsel and did not have the notice sent to him so he could appear for the TRO hearing. She provided that to counsel. Counsel immediately tried to set up depositions. There is communications where he says, I want to do your depositions. The response back was, you can do depositions of my clients. If I can do depositions of your clients at the same time, here are some dates. Then there was an adjournment of the temporary injunction hearing. The hearing took place. We know the story of what happened at the temporary injunction hearing. And following that hearing, after the answer was filed, I was substituted in as counsel. Again, I would ask the court that this is one of those very cases of extreme circumstance where the egregious conduct of Mr. Polich really took off after the motion for default judgment was filed, and his lack of responsiveness in providing information to me and to the trial court as to the extent of the agreements that he had with counsel or believed he had with counsel. The first issue before that trial court was whether there was such an agreement, not whether there was excusable neglect, but whether there was such an agreement. He says there was, it's all over, there's no problem, that's the language that he used. We filed a motion to extend time, filing it in the nature of a conditional motion, saying, well, court, if you find that that's not the case, that his misunderstanding should stand as excusable neglect because it shouldn't impact the client. The later hearing, when we had made repeated attempts to get him to the hearing to testify, and his response, lack of responsiveness, and only response was, I'm not getting paid to be there anymore, indicated that...
I think that answers my inquiry as to whether or not there was evidence in the record.
And we do ask the court...
That does stop your statement.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you.